Internet Talk Radio. The medium is the message.
From San Francisco, welcome to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, with your interview host, Dr. Moira Gunn.
The first program is going to be broken up into 7 files. It makes it easier to transfer the data if it's broken up into smaller chunks. It's also easier on the computers, but what's real nice about it is if you look in a directory that has these files and you say, play them all, you're going to hear the radio as I envision it. You'll hear it in the order that I put it together. But if you want to, you can flip it so that the restaurant review comes before the interview instead of afterwards. In that sense, it is random access radio.
Is the world going digital? Can everything be reduced to just numbers? On this show, Moira first speaks with Carl Melamud, well-known author and executive producer of Internet Talk Radio, the first digitized radio show designed to be played on your computer. And how far does this digital vision of tomorrow reach?
What is interesting about this technology is how it does, I'm not going to say it streamlines our thinking, but it does create a sense of community. And if there's anything that's really important about this digital technology, it's what can we do with it? How can we make this world a better place? You know, how can we change and fix the problems?
Jane Metcalf is president of Wired, a new magazine dedicated to the issues posed by the digital age. From society to government, from business to education, from intrusion on our lives to the realization of our own personal potentials, the digital revolution is here. And now, here's Moira with Carl Melamud.
What is Internet Talk Radio, and what's so different about it?
Well, Internet Talk Radio is a radio station, and the only difference is that instead of using airwaves or satellites to move our information around, we use a global computer network called the Internet.
Now, refresh our listeners. We've talked from time to time about the Internet. What is it?
Well, the Internet is the network of networks. If you think about it, every computer in the world is gradually connecting to every other computer. Today, there's a core of about 1.3 million computers connected in a network of networks, meaning that you can get from one place to another. You can search a database at the University of Minnesota, or you can search a database in Ireland. There is 106 countries that are connected to the Internet. We estimate there's 14 million people. And what's amazing is that this network of networks is growing at 15 to 20% every month.
Your program, though, is digitized, and it is data, if you will, on this network. How do I hear it? How do I hear the radio?
Well, let's first start with how we produce it. We produce radio just like you do, and the end result is a master tape. What we do is we copy that onto a computer at our studios, and that data then moves to another computer in Reston, Virginia, run by UUNET Technologies. And UUNET is kind of the center of the world in many ways. It has many gigabytes of archives for people to search. And what they do is they take this file and they put it on a big computer, and then other networks grab the file. And so EUNET, which is a network that covers 24 countries in Europe, will grab its file from UUNET. And then a network called NordUNET, which serves the Nordic countries, grabs it from EUNET. And so this file kind of starts moving around the world. And eventually it gets to your local network, at which point you would play the file just like you would play any other sound file. If you have a PC that has a CD-ROM drive and you're doing multimedia, you would be playing things. If you have a Macintosh and when you open it up, your Macintosh makes a little noise, well, our half-hour radio program is just a bigger example of that little noise.
Now, can any personal computer play your program, or do I need special hardware and software?
Well, any Macintosh can play it because it's already got sound support. Any Next computer can. If you have a PC, you have a CD-ROM drive, or you have a Sound Blaster board, or any of these very popular additions to a standard IBM PC would let you play that. Most modern computers have sound support already in the operating system.
You mentioned how many people are being added every day. How many people are on Internet here in the United States, and how easy is it to get access?
Well, there's several million people. It's not necessarily easy if you're a consumer at home. On the other hand, every university in the country is on the Internet, and many large corporations are. And increasingly, we're beginning to get individuals that are getting on the network, either by connecting their home network to this network of networks, or by just using a PC and a modem and dialing up a service provider, and that service provider gives you an account.
By a service provider, you're talking about a for-profit service provider.
Well, there's for-profit service providers and there's non-profit. The National Science Foundation started off a program a long time ago called the NSFNet. And the NSFNet is kind of our interstate highway system for the Internet. It's the core backbone, the big stream of data. And they also funded what they call regional networks. And so in Southern California, there's a group called SurfNet, for example. In Northern California, there's BARNET, which is a Bay Area research network. And groups like BARNET and SurfNet are now self-sustaining providers of Internet service. They started out with government help, and very few of them get government help at this point. Their users pay for the service.
Ah, so you can join one of these regional or local networks and with that have access to Internet.
That's right. If you're a small organization, it may not be easy. If you want to come in as an individual, it might even cost $200 or $300 a month to be a true integral part of the network. If you just want an account for yourself, it might cost you, $30 a month. And so it hasn't really reached a home yet, but it's getting there. It's many technologies start in the cities and kind of move out. And in this global village, our cities are places like the universities and the large corporations. And this technology is slowly moving out to the individual.
Now, to hear your radio program, Internet Talk Radio, do I have to pay anything?
My money from advertisers. I have Sun Microsystems and O'Reilly & Associates, which publishes technical material, and they're sponsoring it. And what that means is I can put that file out there and say, you can copy this file as many times as you want. You can change the encoding format so that if you get a copy of the file ready for a Sun workstation and you've got a Macintosh, you can convert the file. The only thing I don't let you do is take my ads out and put your own in. Now, I've got a National Public Radio metaphor. I listen to National Public Radio all the time, and we'd love to be all things considered for the Internet. And so we have very short advertisements. There are 2 or 3 sentences, and they're only a couple times during the programming. This isn't Fox Television or AM radio.
I see. But you're electing to do that.
Of course I am.
As opposed to being told to be doing that.
What I'm doing is what any radio station would do, is I'm basically giving away the programming and selling back my demographics and my user base to my advertisers. You do the same thing. You have sponsors like the MacArthur Foundation that sponsor National Public Radio activities. You have individual users that sponsor it. And I decided that pledge drives probably won't work on the Internet, and so I'm doing everything through advertising.
As I understand it, there are appropriate use policies which apply to the Internet. Do those govern any of this advertising or credits?
Well, there's 2 answers to the appropriate use problem. Answer number 1 is all I'm doing is putting my programs on a commercial service provider called UUNet. And if one of your users takes that file and crosses your network and violates your appropriate use policies, I don't have an appropriate use problem. You have one. Now, that's the harsh answer. The unharsh answer is that my programming is very substantive. This is very technical information. Our first program is called Geek of the Week, and Geek of the Week is an interview show with prominent members of the technical community. And so I went to the National Science Foundation and NASA and these other groups that run large government backbones, and because it's government funds, they have appropriate use policies. And these folks looked at what I'm doing, and they said, well, on the face of it, you have in-depth interviews with people that help build the Internet, and there may be a couple sentences at the end saying this program was paid for with support from an organization. You know, that meets our appropriate use criteria.
Ah, so it
so
is
I've
an
been
area.
Cleared.
You've been cleared by the government.
By the government, no less. But what's important to understand is that each network has its own appropriate use policy, and it turns out that most networks have very few restrictions. If you pay your money, you can transfer almost any data that's on there. You can't hurt other people. But as far as the type of data, most networks are getting out of these appropriate use restrictions. They're impossible to enforce, for one thing.
Let's get to the meat of this. Tell us about the radio program itself. What can I hear if I listen to it?
Well, my first channel, if you will, is Internet Talk Radio, and we're starting off with Geek of the Week. And so when you tune in, when you start playing these files, you'll hear an interview. And for my first interview, I have Dr. Marshall T. Rose, who I consider to be one of the world's leading network programmers. He's helped build many of the tools that today's Internet is based on. I have another interview with Milo Medine, who is manager of NASA's network, and NASA runs by far one of the largest networks in the world. And I talk to these people about the issues that are important to them. How do we build a global network? How do we turn this from a network of 14 million people into a network of 140 million people, or 1.4 billion people? And these issues of scaling and of the complexity of the network are vital issues today for the folks that are the engineers that are helping to make this Internet.
Now, you have a half-hour program, and it's going to be produced weekly?
Yes, that's right.
How big is it containing?
There's the rub. A half-hour program is about a 15-megabyte file. Actually, the programming that I originally make comes out on a PC on a very special digital mixing studio, and it turns out my original half-hour program is 240 megabytes. It's CD quality. Now, we don't want to be moving files that size around the world. And so what I do is I reduce the file from this very high CD quality down to an acceptable quality, something we call PCM. And PCM is about the quality that you would hear on a good telephone line.
Ah, so that you're compressing the data and reducing it.
Well, I'm reducing it. I'm not compressing it. I'm changing the encoding format. I'm changing the number of samples per second, and the number of samples per second influences how good a fidelity you get on the final product.
So when I buy a compact disc with music on it, of course, that's a very complex structure I'm listening to, music, and to get the full fidelity, you would have a lot of data. And what we're saying is, since most of this is talk, what we've discovered on, for instance, the long-distance phone lines, is that if we took out a good piece of the information, literally just took it out, we'd still be able to understand it very comprehensively.
Oh, it's fine. It's good enough. I mean, we don't need full quality. We'd love to have it, but we can't afford it. We don't have links big enough on our networks to support true CD quality, at least yet.
Are there any concerns about overloading the network?
Well, I think there's plenty of room for 15-megabyte files, and what we're doing is working with the networks of the world. When we go on the air, we're going to reach 26 different countries, and what I'm doing is working with networks, trying to get an orderly distribution path for this data. Ultimately, though, all bets are off. Ultimately, the data doesn't have copy restrictions on it. And what we're trying to do is what we do with all the other large archives on the Internet, is to get it close to the people so that they don't have to cross a transatlantic link in order to get the information. We don't have 1,000 people all transferring their own copy of the data across a transatlantic link.
So what we're saying is that when you digitize your data and you deliver it to UUNet, that, in fact, someone just doesn't go to UUNet to get it. That is, in fact, copies of it are then distributed internationally so that someone can go to their nearest network site to get it.
When we get data on the network, we use something called the Anonymous File Transfer Protocol, usually. And what anonymous means is that anybody can get it. You don't need a username and a password. We're just putting this library out there for anybody to get. And what we're doing is we're not at the top of the hierarchy using anonymous FTP. We're giving people passwords. And so I give that password out to large networks, and they grab the file, and they'll give their passwords out to smaller networks. And eventually, the data is just sitting there. And somebody may even offer it by this anonymous file transfer protocol, but we're just trying to get an orderly head start.
For those people who heard that FTP in the middle, that's the file transfer protocol.
You bet. I live in an acronym-intensive environment here, so we use a lot of acronyms. In fact, one of our features on Geek of the Week, we're going to try to break it up a little bit so it's not all interview. We're going to have Name That Acronym. And, of course, our first acronym is going to be P2C2E, which is a process too complicated to explain. That comes from Salman Rushdie's Haroon and the Sea of Stories. We have other little featurettes, too. We have The Incidental Tourist, and we're going to start off with a restaurant review in Prague. We have BookBite, in which Dan Dornberg, who runs one of the world's largest computer bookstores, does a book review for us each week.
Now, in terms of, we've just been talking about a large data file, and you were saying, wait a minute, you know, we really have this program broken down into multiple files or multiple segments. Does this have anything to do with random access radio?
Yes, it does. In fact, it's not one big file. The first program is going to be broken up into 7 files. It makes it easier to transfer the data if it's broken up into smaller chunks. It's also easier on the computers, but what's real nice about it is if you look in a directory that has these files and you say, play them all, you're going to hear the radio as I envision it. You'll hear it in the order that I put it together. But if you want to, you can flip it so that the restaurant review comes before the interview instead of afterwards. In that sense, it is random access radio.
And for those of you who are just about to get out of their car and go into the hardware store, you could stop and resume later after you came out of the hardware store, ultimately.
That's correct. You can stop it, you can rewind it, you can fast forward it. And what's nice is eventually we can turn this into a new medium. I say we're starting with a radio metaphor. And that's because it's a metaphor that you're familiar with. You know what radio's like. But we're going to modify that metaphor and change it to suit this new medium, the Internet. And so, for example, we can do things like eventually we can go live, at least live within the confines of a network, and we can have things like interactive game shows. We want to bring Name That acronym up to the game show status so that everybody listening can be playing along with the game show at the same time. In that sense, it's much like interactive TV or interactive radio. It's as if you were listening to the radio and you turn to it and talk back, and the people at the station can hear you.
If you've just turned in, you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Dr. Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Carl Malamud, executive producer of Internet Talk Radio. Carl, how did the concept of Internet Talk Radio come to you?
Well, I've written a lot of books about computer networks, and I've written for the trade press when I have to pay the rent. You don't make a living writing books, of course, unless you happen to be lucky. And I looked at the trade press, and nobody was really dealing with the Internet. We were getting lots of product reviews, but no one was sitting down and explaining the technology that really makes these networks happen. And it's a complex beast. There are thousands and thousands of people that spend their entire professional lives building the Internet, and there's tens and thousands of people that are following it, that are interested. And so I looked at that and said, you know, I really ought to start a magazine. But when you start a magazine, that costs you $2 million. And the reason is because you have to get that paper out to people. And I thought about it and said, you know, this is silly. I've got a distribution network already in place. And then I looked at all the multimedia work that's been going on at places like Xerox's Palo Alto Research Center and Lawrence Berkeley Laboratories. And it was pretty obvious that technology was coming out of the research labs and into the field. And I thought, well, let's start a radio station. Let's see what we can do there. And it turns out that I'm calling this desktop broadcasting because for under $100,000, I was able to put together a radio station that reaches 26 different countries the day that it goes on the air, which will be March 31st.
Mm. Well, what is desktop broadcasting? And what does that mean to the normal individual?
Well, desktop broadcasting is a cliche that I've just invented. It's just as bad as
client-server
computing or whatever you want. But the point of it is that anybody can be a radio station. Anyone can produce information. Now, not anybody can produce high-quality information. And one of the keys in looking at Internet talk radio is the real important part here is not the networks and the radio and the multimedia. The important part is the journalism. And people look at something like Internet talk radio, and sometimes they say, oh, that's going to drive traditional radio out of business. Well, that's wrong, because traditional radio is not about airwaves. It's about producing good programming. And the fact that it goes over a computer network instead of an airwave is almost irrelevant.
Well, let's kind of go back to the technical side of this. When I play it on my PC, can I do any other work on my computer?
Yes, you can. If you're running Windows 3.1 and if you're running an 8386 or 486 casting support, what you may find on a PC is an occasional pause in either the sound or the program that you're working on while the computer slices between one program and the other. On a more modern machine, like a Sun workstation, for example, it's no problem. You come in the morning, you double-click on the radio icon, and while you're listening to the radio, you read your mail or, you know, prepare the memo for the boss or whatever it is you have to do.
So that's sort of how you envision perhaps this being done, is that you're listening to it while you're doing some other tasks that don't take a lot of brain power.
That's the main reason we're using radio instead of text. Everybody gets too much text today. I don't know about you, but I get 200 or 300 electronic mail messages every single day. And that's not counting all the stuff I have to read. And there's a fundamental rule, which is you can't read two things at once, or at least I can't. But you can read something and you can listen to the radio at the same time.
Now, if I have a data file containing your radio program on my computer, can I convert it to a cassette tape so I can play it in my car?
Well, you could do that, although I have a friend who is going to do the following. He's going to plug his Macintosh PowerBook into his corporate network, suck the data in, take that Macintosh, stick it on the car seat next to him, plug it into the cigarette lighter, and listen to the radio that way on the way home. But yeah, you can make a cassette tape. You can broadcast it over your local student radio station if you want.
So you could take this normal cassette player and just tape it while your computer's playing, is what you're saying.
Exactly.
Okay. Are there any new products coming down the line that are going to help this whole situation?
What do you mean by that? What kind of products?
Well, I'm thinking that are we expecting to get a lot more audio and or video data over data networks?
Yeah, you're going to get a whole bunch more. Networks are moving from being a text-only medium into being a general purpose infrastructure. The thing that makes the internet so attractive is that infrastructure is in place to move data from any one point to any other point. And you're going to see an explosion in different kinds of data. And it's not going to be just plain old video and audio. It's going to be things like the Wide Area Information Server called Waves. A gentleman named Brewster Kahle has developed that. And Waves is a worldwide library of databases all put together in a seamless fashion. And what you do is you ask questions in plain English, like, is there any information about biology? And back on your screen comes a list of databases around the world. And you click on one and you start asking specific questions. Do you have any information about invertebrate physiology, for example? And you get back a list of bibliographic citations, and you click on a document, and the document comes back. And it's not just scientific information that's in Waze. There's things like the entire text of the Bible and the Quran and the Torah, Shakespearean love sonnets, information about maps. You can give a latitude and a longitude and get back a map of that area.
It's amazing how much information is actually available. In fact, that's the hard part for me. There's so much information. What is the information I really do need to know, and don't give me any more?
Well, and that's where a new set of very exciting services that are coming out on the network. There's an area of research called resource discovery. And resource discovery is attempting to solve the problem of literally millions of databases and trying to find what's relevant. And people are writing intelligent computer programs that go out on the net and do the looking for you. A professor at University of Colorado, Michael Schwartz, has developed a tool called NetFind. And NetFind finds an electronic mail address for somebody and uses a dozen different techniques to find that so that you don't have to do it yourself. And there's other resource discovery protocols. There's something called Gopher, which comes out of the University of Minnesota. And the Internet Gopher goes out and gets information for you and brings it back. It's a very easy way of dealing with information.
Incredible. Now, I know how our program is produced, and we talked about that earlier, and we do old-fashioned reel-to-reel tape, so we may not exactly be the same as you, but we're in our public radio production studios, and we record these interviews, and then we edit and mix and come up with a master tape like you do. Now, the difference is that every Tuesday morning, we uplink our tape in real time. That takes 60 minutes, because we're an hour program, up to the public radio satellite on Channel 6. There we are. And the satellite then broadcasts that in turn all over the United States so that stations who take our show need to set up the tape and record it on that Tuesday. Given our 60-minute master tape, how could we digitize it and put it on Internet?
Well, all you need is an analog-to-digital converter. Ship me the tapes, and I'll copy them in and put them on the network.
Put them on the network. Now, there we get to it. So initially, though, when we would copy it over, because we're twice as long as you are, we'd be 480 megabytes. That's basically 500 million bytes of information.
Well, we wouldn't ship a half a gigabyte over the network. My initial data format is that big, and what I do is I crunch it down locally before it actually hits the network. That's just too big to be moving around anything but a few special purpose links. There are links that will handle it. I mean, there are links that run at a gigabit per second. And if you want a 500 megabytes, it's really not that big a deal.
Now, if I extrapolated then on the numbers that you very kindly sent me earlier, if one of our loyal listeners had a 2400 baud modem, it would take, after you reduced it down to the 30 megabytes, it would take about 28 hours to download our program.
That would be a very brave person doing that. Now, there are people
that
will
do that. We have
loyal
listeners.
But it's, I'm not aiming to start out with to reach everybody in the world. When you start a new infrastructure, when you start a new medium, you aim at the folks that are connected. You start in the cities and then move out to the country. And our country today are the individuals in the homes with the 2400 baud modems. That's like being in the middle of Kansas. It's the same thing.
How fast will they have to get to before... I mean,
you can compress the information and get it down to a data stream that today's high-speed modems running at 9,600 bits per second can handle. You can almost listen to it in real time at that rate. It's not very high audio quality. The magic number, though, for me is 6,000 bits per second, which is a factor of six or so faster than most modems you would find on a PC today.
But certainly on the horizon.
It's on the horizon. In fact, it turns out there's a technology called ISDN. And ISDN is a way for the telephone companies to run two 64,000 bit per second links into your home using today's existing wiring. You don't have to run fiber optic into the house in order to do that. Now, I'm not a big fan of ISDN. I think we need bigger bandwidth. I think we need better technology. I think ISDN may be complex. But there's something very important, which is ISDN is there. It's been deployed. Pacific Bell has it deployed. Bell Atlantic has it deployed. And we might as well use it.
Now, just real quickly, ISDN stands for?
Integrated Services Digital Network. You didn't want to know that, did you?
What's ISDN? What's ISDN?
So, ISDN's
that's my job.
ISDN's an international standard, and it's been a long, long push by the telephone companies to get this out there. And it's taken an incredibly long time to deploy it because people are thinking in 20 and 30-year time frames. And we don't live in a 20 to 30-year world anymore. We live in a 2 to 3-year world. So those of us in the computer industry are frustrated when we see a 10 or 15-year rollout on some technology.
You know, it's funny. There are just books and movies and all kinds of things filled with stories of people who were laughed at when they attempted something because they had a vision of what was coming, and in the end, usually in the movies, everything turns out swell, and people say, "Gee, we shouldn't have laughed at you." But the fact of the matter is that our experience in the last 10 years is that technology is moving in these massive surges forward, so that where you are is really where we now talk about strategically people want to place themselves. Don't wait for the technology to be on your doorstep. Anticipate what's coming down and make a surge to get out there, if you will. Even with that, was there any reluctance on your part to begin?
You mean did I meet with resistance from folks? A lot of people looked at the idea of a commercial radio station on the Internet and just kind of blinked a few times and said, come again. But most people, and in fact the people I'm aiming at, look at it and say, yeah, it's very feasible. You know, I didn't invent anything. What I'm doing is I'm taking technology that people all over the world have been developing, and I just saw a way to combine my job, which is writing about the technology, with the network. That's all I'm doing. It's a clever hack, that's all.
Now I'm going to take just a little tangent here and ask you something about just using the Internet. And there's two terms which fascinate me, and I'm hoping you can explain it. What's the difference between, and these are users of the Internet, what's the difference between a flamer and a firefighter?
Well, flaming is when somebody sends you a nice message saying, well, what are you doing for lunch? And you send a message back going, again, I told you last week, what's the matter with you? And that's flaming. And it turns out that when you don't see people, when you don't get visual cues, and when you don't hear their voice, it's very easy to misunderstand what they said. And particularly, you may misunderstand a joke for being serious. And when you react badly, you flame. And in fact, there's people that flame so much, we call it going nonlinear. In normal English, that would be being totally hysterical, that when somebody really goes over the edge, Internet talk radio will induct that person into the Internet Hall of Flame. That's a distinction we reserve for only a few people. So a flamer is someone who just goes off, and the networks have way too many flamers. Firefighters are people that try to reduce the flames.
And how do they do that?
Oh, you know, when somebody goes nonlinear, usually a few people can talk to them and try at least on a private basis to get things under control. A lot of people don't understand when they're using electronic mail that they may be speaking to 2,000 or 3,000 people. And it's so easy to be sitting there looking at a screen and just say, reply. You get a message and it's addressed to one of these large discussion groups and it says something stupid. And you reply. You wouldn't get up in front of a convention of 3,000 people and say, oh, this is really stupid. You'd think about what you want to say and you try to phrase it in more diplomatic language. But people often forget what they're doing on the networks. And usually if you talk to them and say, well, you know, it's not that bad, and here's the other guy's point of view, usually things kind of take it easy.
Now, let me ask you one last question. Right now you're mounting the audio campaign. What about video?
Well, we want to do two things. We want to add video and other data types. I mean, video and audio are just two data types. But we also want to go live. We want to see an internet town hall where our national leaders can come on the internet and have a live video conference with people and talk to them. And I think when we hear in our last political campaign about a town hall, I naturally think of the internet. I don't think of a bunch of 800 numbers. I think of a forum where you can really, you can talk to people and work with them, and you can have instantaneous polls, and you can have databases supporting the issues being discussed so you can get more information.
I think also in the town halls, people see themselves as sitting around their television sets, and that wouldn't necessarily be the case.
Well, you know, a computer monitor is sort of like a television set.
So they'd be getting data on the internet, and they'd be seeing the town or participating in the town hall through their computer.
But it's important to remember that we can mix technologies, and so even if we do an internet town hall on the internet and bring labor union officials in to talk to the Secretary of Labor and the rest of us listen in, you can also listen in via C-SPAN or National Public Radio or any other place. You don't have to have everybody in the country engaged in one large conversation. You just want a forum where groups of people can engage in those conversations.
Right. Carl, I want to congratulate you on having and implementing this vision, and good luck.
Well, thank you.
Moira's first guest has been Carl Melamud, executive producer of Internet Talk Radio, the first digital radio show. It's now available via modem to over 10 million users of the Internet Global Computer Network. You're listening to TechNation, Americans and Technology. Where else will we see the effects of the digital revolution? Jane Metcalf is president of Wired, a new magazine about the digital age and how our lives are being transformed by it.
Tell us about Wired magazine.
Wired is our reaction to the computer press and the business press and the lifestyle press's attempt to talk about technology. It really was so inappropriate for the way we were perceiving the changes in our world that it just seemed to us that if we could look at it from a slightly different angle, an overview, and talk about it in a way that wasn't confined to the speeds and feeds or the bits and bytes, and that wasn't a pure business story either, then we could encompass some of the conversations that we were having with people when we went to trade shows or conferences, and some of the discussions we would have with other non-technical people, explaining to them what we saw was happening.
In your premier issue, you quote Marshall McLuhan's famous 1967 book, The Medium is the Message, and you say the medium or process of our time, electric technology, I like that description from 1967, is reshaping and restructuring patterns of social interdependence and every aspect of our personal lives. It is forcing us to reconsider and reevaluate practically every thought, every action, and every institution formerly taken for granted, and it's changing dramatically. Marshall McLuhan is listed on your masthead as patron saint.
Well, we actually, with the original startup team, sat around and talked about who our saints would be, and I think the one person that everyone universally admired and respected was McLuhan. His prescience is astonishing, that what he would write about when actually referring to television could be so true in talking about computers.
Also joining us today is Louis Rossetto, editor and publisher of Wired. Louis, welcome.
Good to be here, Maura.
In line with what we've just been talking about, in the initial editorial page, it says, we know a lot about digital technology, and we're bored by it.
Well, the story today isn't the technology. It's the people and the companies and the ideas that are changing our world. And the technology is rapidly receding into the background as it becomes just part of our everyday lives. What's important now are the ideas and the people that are reshaping how we educate, how we entertain, how we do business, how we trade, just about every aspect of our lives.
Well, in line with this idea that the magazine is not truly about technology, make no mistake, it does report the latest, fastest, smallest, newest stuff, but it's not reported as if it's interesting in and of itself. It's only interesting in context. One difference between Wired and what might be perceived as a technology magazine or might be considered a technology age magazine is that there's no underground mentality. There's no us versus them, no we get it and they don't get it. You talk about and we hear about and we hear from powerful people.
Well, that's an interesting remark, actually. I think what we've tried to do with the magazine is have it be inclusive, have it bring together all these previously unconnected communities. They're united by the technology. They now have a common set of tools for solving their problems, their creative problems, their business problems, and so forth. And what's really interesting to us is how that unites us, not how that pits us against somebody else.
It's interesting that Time magazine just had cyberpunks on the cover of one of their issues recently. And to us, it was an indication that cyberpunks are finally dead, that the whole movement is finally over. It's sort of like hippies reaching the cover of Time magazine in 1967. What it really means is that the cyberpunk movement and the ideas and the spirit of it has finally permeated culture in general, so that instead of talking about cyber culture, we're talking about just culture now. What the digital vanguards and visionaries have done is have brought their vision to the world, and now that vision has become the dominant one in our society.
Louis, tell us about what topics are your favorites at Wired?
It has to do with the new. It has to do with finding the edge of what's coming. And that encompasses just about all the things we look at. That's politics, that's business, that's entertainment, that's ideas as well. It has to do with seeing this new world that's evolving and seeing the most exciting changes that are happening around us and bringing them to other people. That's the mission of Wired, basically.
There are many, many different facets to Wired magazine, and I must say I enjoyed your tired versus Wired list. Gore is wired while Clinton is tired, and the Sega ad campaign is wired while the Energizer Bunny campaign is tired. And I did notice that the BBC was wired while NPR was tired. That's okay. We're an independent production on public radio. What makes the BBC wired, and what makes NPR tired?
My response to that would be that the BBC is global. It's news from around the world reported to you by people in those nations. And the NPR view is very American-centric.
Yeah, I think that is the essence of that particular comment, that the BBC is reporting on a lot of different events locally in a global way, and NPR is reporting globally in a local way. In that its focus is purely American, where the BBC is truly an international operation that talks to everybody simultaneously around the world. So they have a very global sense of the way the world is.
And it is called the BBC World Service.
Exactly.
Exactly.
One example of putting technology in context is an article by Connie Guglielmo about how CNN stunningly captured an international audience during the Gulf War, including Saddam Hussein, and how for the first time CNN had used 4 mobile satellite TV stations. These stations were roughly $250,000 and could simply be shipped as excess baggage with TV crews. Before the Gulf War, there were between 30 and 40 licensed mobile satellite TV stations. By the time the war was over, just a few weeks later, there were over 130. And what I came away with as a burning issue was not, gosh, what's the next technology, but rather the context of the technology, my own expanding thoughts and fears about what this meant to our global society, and me and my family in particular. Is this the whole trend that we're looking at?
Isn't the world getting to be a small place? Isn't it hard to think about having wars in a village? And this is, you know, part of the changes that are happening now. I think that everybody is feeling personally what's happening in Sarajevo, for example, Bosnia, or Russia, in almost the same, well, perhaps not the same personal emotional way that they do with something that's happening down the block, but not too far from it. And I think this is one of the things, one of the better things of technology, that it makes what previously had been remote and impersonal events, it brings them to you and makes them real and makes them unthinkable and makes them something that you want to obliterate forever from human experience. And I think that is one of the really great things that's happening now.
You attracted some very well-known authors to Wired, Nicholas Necroponte, director of MIT's Media Lab, Stuart Brand, John Markoff of the New York Times. How did you go about looking for writers, and what did you tell them that you wanted them to do?
The writers actually found us in a lot of cases. We used to produce a magazine in Amsterdam called Electric Word, which was circulated internationally, and it was very leading edge and had the slight cult edge to it as well. It was a thoughtful magazine, and a lot of very interesting people read it. When we moved to the States to produce this magazine, the reputation preceded us in a sense. We offered them a platform to do the kind of writing that they can't do in other publications. A newspaper will only allow you to go so deep because it's got a much broader circulation and you've got to make sure it's not too specialized. Computer magazines, as we mentioned before, are focused on the technology and on selling that technology, and the business publications are skirting over the top of what's really happening and what the meaning and context is. So when we came to the States and said, here's a chance for you to do the kind of writing that you'd really like to do if you weren't busy doing your day job, people came to us.
Well, I personally see Wired as a sort of a Vanity Fair of technology, and Vanity Fair, for those of our listeners who are not familiar with it, is a very with-it mainstream international publication with a certain irreverence about it. A similar example in your premier issue is the Stuart Brand interview with Camille Paglia and her handwritten corrections, which were faxed back to you. Tell us about that article.
We did the interview with Camille, and Stuart put it all together, and we faxed Camille the text. She faxed back her comments, just written on top of the fax that we had sent out. And we realized that here was an example of a subject in a magazine actually putting her hand to the text that we generated. And it struck us as a great thing to include in the magazine, because magazines and media in general sort of separate you from the subjects. They produce something artificial. And in fact, here we have her handwriting and her comments in the margins about things that we had included in the story that she had said at the time, and corrections of things that we had misheard or that she had not exactly amplified. And it gives a sense of being a human involved in the process rather than just some anonymous subject of some large corporate process to generate media.
It's also an example of the collaborative nature of media as well. I mean, you're not, as a writer or an editor, doing it all out there by yourself and generating fully finished, polished text. It's back and forth, and that was good to bring out.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans in Technology. I'm Dr. Moira Gunn, and my guests today are Jane Metcalf, president of Wired Magazine, and Louis Rossetto, the editor and publisher. Let's talk about some of the topics that Wired addresses, such as the future of war and cellular phone freaks. Tell us about some of those topics.
We had Bruce Sterling go to Washington, go to Fort Knox, Kentucky, and go to a conference in Texas on virtual warfare. And the subject of his piece was the Army's efforts to simulate warfare so as to better train the troops and to basically reduce costs as well. Their argument is that the only way that you can have well-trained troops is to have them fighting as units. And isolated simulators are good for developing individual skills, but do not bring out unit skills and or even large unit skills in battle conditions. You can hone those in large exercises, which is what the government used to do. But increasingly, that becomes difficult as they use a lot of resources. They tear up the countryside. They get the neighbors all upset, as they did in Germany and in the Midwest in America. So they're developing a new system for training troops. It's battle simulation. They have tank simulators where the tank crew sits inside of a jacuzzi-designed or a jacuzzi-manufactured tank replica interior that's networked together with other tanks in a virtual battlefield. And they're given a terrain, a geo-mapped terrain from satellites and computer enhancement, and they basically fight wars in cyberspace, in virtual reality. One interesting result of this was the recent Gulf War, where pilots had been flying bombing runs over Baghdad for years before they actually flew the real missions in simulators over these landscapes that had been generated from satellite imagery. I would also like to add that it's an important development. It's the American Army considers it a strategic advantage to have troops so well trained in high technology weaponry, and fighting against troops who may have high technology weaponry but aren't as well trained. So the training itself becomes a source of strategic advantage for the United States. So it's a way of downsizing the American Army and at the same time maintaining lethality, basically, while not consuming a lot of resources.
One of the interesting things that Bruce brought back from his travels and interviews was the sense that the guys involved in designing these simulation exercises, he said they think just like us. The scary thing is they are just like us, which I thought was an amazing thing for an underground cyberpunk science fiction author to come back and say. And it kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier about how what is interesting about this technology is how it does, I'm not going to say it streamlines our thinking, but it does create a sense of community. And if there's anything that's really important about this digital technology, it's what can we do with it? How can we make this world a better place? You know, how can we change and fix the problems?
The other story that you mentioned was people hacking cellular telephones. And that's a new phenomenon. People are able to reprogram the chips on the chipset on the cellular phones. They're able to compact the code that's there already and then add new code to the top of the chip and reburn the chips and put them back in their phones. And what they're able to do with that is not just listen in on other people's telephone calls, because you can do that with a scanner, but they're able to capture other people's cellular numbers. They're able to clone cellular numbers so you can have multiple numbers with multiple telephones with the same numbers and on and on. So it's an interesting insight to the hacker subculture that will not be repressed.
Right. Your premier issue recently came out, the 150,000 issue. Where was that distributed?
We sent 100,000 copies out onto newsstands, and those went to places like B. Dalton and Walden Books and Safeway and some very general, broad targets. We did not get into small alternative bookstores, and some of our audience may have expected that, but what we are trying to do is grow the magazine from the newsstands, put it out there so that people can find it, so that we don't have to go tracking them down with direct mail, junk mail, basically. And that's how we got rid of 100,000 of them. The additional 50,000 copies were distributed at two conferences and trade shows. Macworld was one of them, and the Consumer Electronics Show was the other one. Since the magazine is positioned at that place where the computer industry meets the consumer electronics industry, it was very important for us to be there and to launch there. And then we mailed out another 25,000 copies to people that might not necessarily have time to go browsing through newsstands or even to go to trade shows anymore. Very interesting people flying around the world, very busy, but who desperately need a sense of how this all fits in, where it's all going, why it's interesting and important.
Are there plans to go international?
We are already international, in fact. We sent 10,000 copies of the first issue abroad. We have distribution in Japan, Europe, Malaysia, Indonesia, places like that, Brazil, Mexico.
Australia.
Australia, New Zealand. Yeah.
Everybody's getting wired.
They're getting wired.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans in Technology. I'm Dr. Moira Gunn, and my guests today are Jane Metcalf, president of Wired Magazine, and Louis Rossetto, the editor and publisher of Wired. Wired was a new concept for a magazine. Was it difficult to get funding for Wired?
Yes, in a word. It's difficult to get funding for any magazine startup, but when you're challenging a lot of the assumptions upon which computer publishing has been built and is succeeding, then you really do go against the grain. There are some formulas for success in technology publishing, which are largely based on describing the technology to someone who has to know about it because their job and their career depends on it. So it's giving them something because if they don't have it, they're afraid. It's selling by fear. What we want to do is break out of that mold altogether and talk about what's really interesting and appealing to them. As a result, we are not as product-driven as the other computer magazines are. But really, as far as fundraising for the magazine goes, that wasn't as an important an issue as our timing was. We came back to the States in 1991, which, for those of us who care to remember of 1991, was a miserable time. The publishing industry had just acknowledged that they were in their worst recession. They called it a depression, in fact, since World War II. The advertising community was badly shaken by the shrinking of advertising budgets. Agencies were being bought up. The media conglomerates were all in turmoil. There was a lot of uncertainty. A lot of what we thought were very promising titles were folding, and no one was in a mood to invest in a startup. So, yes, it was very difficult. I think the two things that saw us through were the people who joined the project, people like Nicholas Negroponte, people like Kevin Kelly, people like John Plunkett, our creative director, people with names and reputations who brought with them their whole subgroup of supporters. And the other thing was just timing. We held on for a long time until we finally did get that funding. And as a result, things were changing. Things were turning around. The administration was changing. The economy was coming back, or else people were just decided they were tired of thinking the economy was going nowhere. So I think that's what brought us through.
You instantly sold out your premier issue, and Wired is now bi-monthly and anticipates becoming monthly. What else is on the horizon for Wired?
We're currently discussing rights in Japan, Spanish language rights. We're considering a Wired book and also talking about perhaps doing stuff with television as well, cable or broadcast.
But the first thing we're going to do, those are sort of far out on the horizon. The first thing we're going to do is develop our presence online. We have an internet address, which is wired.com, and you can contact Louis at lr@wired.com. I'm jane@wired.com. We have a conference on the well. We are developing a folder on America Online, and we're talking about FTP sites and mail servers and other ways that people can log into Wired, get information, communicate with people, update their subscription file, and that kind of thing. And that is something that we'll be putting resources into immediately.
When is your next issue due out?
Hits newsstands on April 27th. We'll be mailing copies to subscribers on the 7th.
Has the early subscription levels been gratifying?
All the commercial side of the magazine is far ahead of projections. We had 10 times as many subscriptions as we had expected when we set out. We've had the sellout on the newsstands is twice as much as we had anticipated. Ad pages are up for the second issue and up for the third issue as well. All in all, we're much farther ahead of our commercial projections than we had anticipated. I think it's just a reflection that we've tapped a current in American society and in the global society that in some ways is manifested by the change of administration. Clinton a few weeks ago stated that we're all children of the information age, that we're all wired for real time, and
thank goodness, and
I think Wired is certainly a reflection of that. I also want to go back one step to the question of the kind of magazine we are. I think every era has its own periodical. In the 30s and 40s, it was Time. In the 60s, it was Playboy. In the 70s, it was Rolling Stone. In the 80s, it was Vanity Fair. I think for the 90s and beyond, I think Wired represents what is going on, the ethos of our period. And I think that's part of why we're getting the response that we are now.
You were talking about Japan, and there is an article in the premier issue about the young Japanese technophile culture, otaku. Tell us about that.
Well, we called them the strange mutant Japanese culture of otaku, which is a little bit computer nerd, but a lot information and media junkie, who focus on how much information they can find and retain, as obscure as it could be. And I think that's a really interesting development. I think the Japanese are way ahead in terms of, what's the word I'm looking for? It's they're mutations of the information age. They're mutant products of the information age. And I think that's pretty interesting.
Now, what are they doing? Are they just trying to get all kinds of information? And
they're just acquiring information. Like, there are otaku who are interested in Godzilla-like monsters. There are otaku who are interested in 18-year-old stars. And they just acquire as much, or otaku interested in German fighting devices. So they acquire as much information as they possibly can. They set up little bulletin boards. They scour books. They look at online. They break into online repositories to get just random facts about these things, and then exchange these facts as though they were currency with other otaku and build reputations for being experts in these certain areas.
I think they're very competitive too. It's an accumulation of information just for the sake of knowing it, but also for the sake of being able to show your friends that you knew that and they didn't.
So this is a little twist on the old computer hacker concept, where you go in and you try to break into as many systems as possible and find out about them. It's that you're breaking in there for a purpose, to get information and take that information back with you.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, your only crime is the breaking in, and presumably all, unless it's espionage type of thing, all the information is generally acceptable facts. There's some variations on the theme. I know we'll return to this another time. Now let me ask both of you, and you can answer in order, any order that you wish. How has your personal involvement with and commitment to Wired changed you?
I like that question, actually. Wired is everything we're interested in. It's technology, it's media, it's people, it's business, it's politics, it's culture. It's everything we're interested in, and the fact that we've been able to design a job that incorporates all of that is something we feel very lucky for. One thing that I think is interesting, the new mood that seems to be sweeping the country is that of tailor a life for yourself, which is not based on a 9-to-5 kind of role where you go and rent your brain out to some corporation in the hopes for security and lifetime employment, because that's a model that's badly shaken, if perhaps not destroyed altogether. And so for us, what we're building here is a life, a business, a lifestyle, and it really is very satisfying.
It's also very hard, too. I should add that. Making a magazine or starting a new business requires such a focused amount of energy. It means throwing your entire self into it. It means basically becoming an obsessive. And a lot of things have, at the moment, receded into the background of our lives. I mean, we're at the office about 16 hours a day, and that leaves about 6 hours for sleep and an hour or two to get back and forth to the office. And I foresee this will be going on for a while. So that it's good that we get everything out of what we're producing and the process that I enjoy enormously as well. But at the same time, it's not cost-free. It is a narrowing in some ways of our personal lives to accomplish a very big goal.
In the tradition of Bright Lights, Big City, why isn't your magazine based in Manhattan? Why San Francisco?
When we left Amsterdam, it was clear to us that the magazine had to be in San Francisco. It seemed like there were more people plugged in, more people were wired already. We would be close to newsmakers. We would be close to advertisers. And there's a large community of people here who could be tapped into to contribute to the magazine. And besides that, I was really tired of gray skies in Northern Europe. And the idea of going to New York and suffering through another climate like that was just unappealing.
Well, also, I think that Silicon Valley is the heartbeat of the global village, and this is where everything is happening. If you were alive at the time of the Roman Empire, you'd want to live in Rome. And at the time of the digital revolution, you want to be at the center of the revolution, and that's here.
My guests today have been Jane Metcalf, president of Wired Magazine, and Louis Rossetto, the editor and publisher. Wired Magazine, a magazine for the digital age, will be out on newsstands again in April. I'm Dr. Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology.
This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco songwriters. Distribution is handled by Larry Goldberg, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Your interview host is Dr. Moira Gunn. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. For Tech Nation, this is Mike Amatori. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of Mogo Tech Media.
This is Internet Talk Radio. You may copy these files and change the encoding format, but may not alter the content or resell the programs. You can send us mail to mail@radio.com. Internet Talk Radio, town crier to the global